Am I satyr or man? Pray tell me who can and settle my place in the scale. A man in ape shape, an anthropoid ape, or monkey deprived of his tail. Then Darwin set forth, in a book of much worth, the importance of nature's selection, how the struggle for life is a laudable strife and results in specific distinction. Let pigeons and doves select their own loves and grant them a million of ages, then doubtless you'll find they've altered their kind and changed into prophets and sages. That's a poem attributed to a gorilla in Punch magazine, 1861. I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Year. Charles Darwin will celebrate his 198th birthday next week, but his ideas on evolution remain controversial today in February 2007. Joining me to talk about evolution are two University of Wisconsin professors involved in an upcoming Darwin Day event, Jenny Bauman in zoology and Brett Pazier in genetics. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Well, let's start by talking about this concept of having a Darwin Day at all, because I was thinking, I can't think of any other scientist. I don't think of an Einstein Day or a Newton Day, Copernicus Day. Maybe there are days like that. But what is sort of the motivating factor behind holding a Darwin Day here and elsewhere in the country?
I think it's partly because you said that the theory is still somewhat controversial. And so it gives us an opportunity to try to demystify the whole idea.
What sorts of events are going to take place on this Darwin Day?
So we have a very exciting schedule planned, and this is an event that's open to the public and, in fact, is intended for the public. And it includes a morning session with some exciting talks from local faculty that are going to be geared towards what we view as kind of public interest on the subject, with sort of a bit of a focus on human evolution. And in the afternoon, we have some exciting interactive displays and educational posters at the Geology Museum, where we have a chance to get into a little bit more detail about topics that are of interest to the public.
Well, and we'll put a link to your website on our University of the Year website here on Public Radio and talk a little bit more about the Darwin Day at the end of this hour. But let's turn back to the birthday man himself, Charles Darwin, born in 1809 in February. What can you tell me about Darwin himself and sort of the situation that led to his creation of these controversial ideas and to what extent he got it right?
To a large extent, he got it right. He came from a fairly well-off family, and his grandfather was an important evolutionary biologist, believe it or not, who had some important ideas that he wrote some books. So Darwin, I think, grew up in a naturalist household where an interest and study of nature were just part of his upbringing. So a lot of these ideas about how the Earth was in terms of geology were things that he studied and thought about, certainly paying attention to the animals and plants in his local communities. And then when he was a young man, he got the chance to work as a naturalist on a ship that was going around the world. And this was one of these things where, at the time, it was a real adventure for a young man, and it potentially could make his career, although I don't think anyone would have predicted the kind of career that came out of that experience for Darwin.
Well, I found it interesting reading about Darwin that his father thought that at one point he might become a clergyman. Darwin writes, "My father perceived that I did not like the thought of being a physician, so he proposed that I should become a clergyman. He was very properly vehement against my turning into an idle sporting man, which then seemed my probable destination. I had scruples about declaring my belief in all the dogmas of the Church of England. Considering how fiercely I have been attacked by the Orthodox, it seems ludicrous that I once intended to be a clergyman. This intention and my father's wish died a natural death when, on leaving Cambridge, I joined the Beagle as a naturalist." But it's interesting that Darwin, in a passage like that, looks back at this controversy even then about going into religion versus going into science. And it has stayed, Darwin's ideas have stayed at that meeting place, that controversial meeting place between religion and science.
It seems so.
What else about Darwin is sort of impressive or striking to you, looking back at him from our vantage point?
Well, I think one thing that's really impressive and worth noting is that when Darwin came along, of course, ideas about biological evolution had been around for some time. And so contrary to some confusion that floats around sometimes. Darwin didn't invent the idea that evolution happens. And in fact, people had amassed a great deal of evidence that evolution occurs by the time he came on the scene. What Darwin suggested was a mechanism for evolutionary change. And the mechanism has a few pieces, but probably the two sort of major tenets are that biological organisms are organized in such a way historically that they share common ancestors, that life on Earth derives from one or a few ultimate ancestors that through many, many generations of reproduction and extinction and proliferation give rise to the diversity of biological species we see today. But Darwin took it a step further and actually said, well, the interesting thing is that there's variation in the ability of individuals to survive and reproduce. And people had noted this previously in the context of different species and sort of competition between species. But Darwin and also Wallace independently pointed out that if we have this inherent variation in survival and reproduction, which everyone can see just looking around the world amongst people and other organisms, and then we allow for that ability to survive and reproduce to be at least partly heritable and therefore passed on from generation to generation, then what we get is this sorting of individuals with different traits that allow them to survive and reproduce. And he called that process natural selection, which is widely viewed as Darwin's most important contribution to evolution and is also widely held as one of the major conceptual advances in all of scientific thought. So that's, I think, the major contribution. Yeah.
Before Darwin, had people been pointing to the close links between primates and human beings? Because, you know, that poem that I opened with that was in Punch just a couple years after the publication of Origin of Species, there's a poem attributed to a gorilla and, you know, really asking, am I a man? Am I a man in ape shape? Lots of the early response that you see to Darwin seems in particular to be focusing on this idea that we're just another ape, that we're just somehow like a chimpanzee or a monkey. And I'm just curious, is that one of the big controversial points there? What is it that makes that so horrifying to the people at his time and now?
From the scientific point of view, there's no controversy whatsoever. I think it, in part because the exact idea isn't quite understood by people, it makes people think we've descended from a monkey, and that's not true. What evolutionary biologists say is that monkeys and humans back in time had an ancestor that's shared. So we both have evolved from that same ancestor. It doesn't mean we're a monkey. It doesn't mean monkeys are people. It means that we're related to one another. Kind of like, this is maybe not the greatest analogy, if you think back to your great 10 times removed grandmother, then you've got relatives, potentially various places in the world, that are related to you at some distance, and you're not going to look exactly the same as them, you might not live in the same place, etc., but you share that ancestry. And it's that idea, but expanded over much, much longer time periods, not just within a human family, but actually across larger differences in life forms.
Right. And Darwin made that observation just by the same way that people might now. Mm-hmm. If they went to a zoo and shared a moment with a chimpanzee, and you could see in behavior and anatomy a great deal of similarity that isn't shared to that extent with other organisms. And the really fabulous finding that was in fact really predicted by Darwin just by making these hypotheses of this extent of phylogenetic kinship or close relatedness with other primates and humans was that similarity that was of interest would also extend to DNA. And what has been one of the modern triumphs of molecular biology is to in fact demonstrate that that's true, that humans and chimpanzees share a remarkable amount of their DNA, which is completely consistent not only with the similarities in anatomy and behavior and physiology, but also with the fossil record.
I would assume those working in your area, genetics, with all the recent developments in terms of understanding the DNA structure and the code and so on, must have wished they could go back and tell Darwin about it, you know, because Absolutely. He was working from a surface level, trying to figure out the mechanism without having the knowledge of all those amino acids and everything else that would have helped him understand the process.
That's right. It makes it all the more remarkable when you realize that he didn't really understand how genetics works.
Right. I think it is worth acknowledging, however, that the topic of evolution and the concept of evolution triggers anger and concern. It did back then and continues to do so today. Here's a letter from back then from Thomas Carlyle, a Victorian. A sentence in Catechism says, "What is the chief end of man? To glorify God and enjoy him forever. No gospel of dirt teaching that men have descended from frogs through monkeys can ever set that aside." You know, so this gospel of dirt idea, and here's another one. This is a friend of Darwin's, George Romanes, who changed his mind. "Never in the history of man has so terrific a calamity befallen the race as that which all who look may now behold advancing as a deluge, black with destruction, resistless in might, uprooting our most cherished hopes, engulfing our most precious creed, and burying our highest life in mindless desolation. The floodgates of infidelity are open, and atheism overwhelming is upon us." Do you want to comment about that and about the presence of that sentiment today?
It does seem to still be around. I guess I can't agree with the point of view for a couple of reasons, which is that there's nothing in Darwin's ideas that says that people shouldn't have religious belief. This is a scientific theory. It's not a theology. And I think part of the reason why it bothers a lot of people who have strong religious beliefs is they somehow feel as though it's attacking those beliefs. It's never intended to do so. There are many, many evolutionary biologists who have strong religious beliefs, and for them, there's no problem. They don't see that they have to select one or the other. Their religion helps them to understand all their spiritual matters, and their science helps them to understand the way things work. And those two things don't have to be in opposition to one another. They can and often are in harmony. And so it would be nice if a little bit of what happens when we do this Darwin Day is that we can lay to rest some of those issues. So yeah, those sentiments are strong, and they have been around for some time. I personally think that Darwin's idea is a beautiful theory, and to cast it in this dark light of infidelity and, you know, dashing God's wisdom, etc., seems to me, I guess I just don't see it that way. And this sort of maybe relates to some other controversial scientific theories that have happened. So, for example, Copernicus and Galileo. Copernicus originally had the idea, and Galileo amassed evidence and then promulgated this idea that the Earth is not the center of the universe. That was at the time seen as a completely heretical notion that went against everything that church taught. And that's no longer a problem. So we no longer think that if we have a strong religious belief of whatever religion, that means we have to reject this theory that the sun is actually the center of our galaxy, but the sun's not even the center of the universe. And so we've learned so much to understand sort of how our planetary system fits into the rest of the universe. And hopefully we can kind of get over that hurdle with evolution too. It's not intended to say that there is no God or that people who have religious beliefs are somehow wrong. It's intended to explain the way that life has come to be.
Well, this is a question I'm going to throw out next week as well to Sean Carroll when we talk to him about his book, The Making of the Fittest. But usually people refer to, as you did just now, evolution as a scientific theory. But we talk about Newton's laws. And so when you use that phrase scientific theory, that it then opens up, as it has among school boards with the intelligent design idea and other things, if you call it a scientific theory, it implies it's one of many ways of looking at scientific facts around us. In the case of evolution, however, I gather from what you've said and what most scientists say that this is something that's relatively incontrovertible. Mm-hmm. So why is it called a theory?
So it comes from a basic misunderstanding of what a theory is. And I blame ourselves for this. I think that in public education, we have somehow failed people in trying to understand what it means. So the first thing I would say is that any explanation for any body of facts in a scientific context is continually being refined and tested. It's part of the scientific process. This comes in contrast to what often happens in the context of religion, where an explanation is deemed irrefutable from the beginning and not subject to testing. And so a basic tenet of science is that we sort of go with the best explanation that we have, given all of the evidence that's been gathered at that time, and then continue to propose refinements of that explanation to better understand the world. It's worth saying, of course, that Newton's laws are hardly laws.
And
in fact, you know, the 20th century saw a major attack on the generality of the ideas that Newton proposed. Does that mean that Newton was wrong? No, it means he was right for some things. And that's also true of Darwin, and it's going to be true of any scientist. It's also true of Einstein. And so what we do is, as a field, we have the wonderful opportunity of choosing the pieces of scientific ideas that are accompanied by the most evidence and synthesizing them and integrating them and you know, analyzing the extent to which they're in conflict. And so this idea of the word theory as a statement about the lack of certainty, in some sense, is true because we never really know everything that's happening, or else, you know, if we are in that situation, then science would not be necessary any longer. But I think that the word theory should be treated in this context as something more active rather than literal. So something that is just meaning that it's a work in progress. But there's, you know, in the case of evolution and natural selection, Ray Darwin, there is a lot of work that has been done to get this progress. So it doesn't mean that there aren't a strong foundation behind it.
Yeah, the other thing is that when an idea might first be proposed, it's deemed a hypothesis, and it's put out there and then tested, and it's either refuted, and we prove that it's wrong, or it's not. And we say, okay, we haven't yet been able to prove that this idea is wrong, so let's go to the next step, and let's see if we test this hypothesis again, can we prove it's wrong? And if we can't, then we keep it. It's still the best explanation. And if that happens on lots of different fronts, which is true for evolutionary theory, then time and time again, we can't prove that it's wrong. And if you take the genetic data, the biogeographic data, the behavioral data, the anatomical data, just all the data that supports Darwin's theory, geological data, and you test all of this theory against all of these kinds of data, and over and over and over and over again, you can't prove it's wrong, it becomes a theory. It's now raised to the level of no longer just a hypothesis. We have massive amounts of data that tell us that this is right. This is not just a hypothesis. It's not just a theory. Gravity is just a theory. Kind of hard to prove that one's wrong, you know? So Brett's right that theories in science are, I would love it if I have an idea that gets elevated to a theory at some point in my career, because basically it takes massive amounts of testing and data to develop a theory.
Now, you referred to evolution as something that you see as beautiful.
I sure do.
Can you give me an example of that, or what you mean by that?
Oh, there's so many things.
Because that's
a sort of
subjective, non-scientific term, but it's still worth thinking about.
There's so many ways in which I think this is a beautiful idea, and maybe the most beautiful idea to me. Well, there's two most beautiful ideas. One is I find it profound beyond my ability to express it, that I'm related to every single other living thing on this world. I don't need more than that. The other thing that I think is beautiful about this idea is that there's this amazingly simple process that has as its natural outcome evolutionary change. And that amazingly simple process is natural selection. It's just the logical conclusion, almost, of this idea that Brett expressed, where you've got, say, one species, and lots of individuals vary in how tall they are, And it turns out that the tallest individuals can't get enough to eat, and they're more likely to die in times of shortage of food. And the short individuals can't run fast enough away from their predators, so they get eaten more easily. And it's the middle-sized individuals that happen to survive and make babies. Well, over time, those tall and short individuals are basically taken out of the population, and what you've got left are the middle ones. And that's evolutionary change, and it's also a simple process, and I think it's a beautiful one because it's so elegant.
Elegant, although a little cruel for the tall and short ones along the way. There is that, too. We're going to have more on the process of evolution when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
At portalwisconsin.org, visitors can navigate content through a variety of means, including searches by keyword, subject area, and date. Content is updated almost daily. Wisconsin Public Radio is pleased to invite you to visit portalwisconsin.org.
A man has no reason to be ashamed of having an ape for his grandfather. If there were an ancestor whom I should feel shame in recalling, it would rather be a man who plunges into scientific questions with which he had no real acquaintance, only to obscure them by an aimless rhetoric and skilled appeals to religious prejudice. Those are the remarks of Thomas Huxley. I'm Emily Auerbach, and with me in the studio for University of the Air today are Jenny Bauman and Brett Pacher. We're talking about Darwin Day coming up next weekend on the University of Wisconsin campus, and it gives us a time to reflect about Charles Darwin and how his ideas of evolution are with us today. So let me start by just asking you, to what extent does evolution matter today? If we just look around us in the world we live in, how does it matter?
It matters a lot. There are contexts in both basic science, but also applied science and direct applications to people's lives of evolution on an everyday level. And we can sort of walk through several different kinds of examples. One of my favorites, since we're in Wisconsin, is that a lot of the basic principles that underlie the ability to improve crops and animals in a farming context derive directly from evolutionary ideas. So when farmers choose those cattle that yield the highest volume and quantity of milk, they are selecting them in the sense of Darwin. The environment has become a human one, but the principles are the same. That is, with evolutionary principles in mind, we can predict, once we understand something about the genetic basis of that trait, we can predict how quickly the milk yield will change in a short period of time. And this is something that animal and plant breeders know quite well, but it's also the same principles and equations are used in general to understand the rate and intensity of evolutionary change. So that's one example of how it matters in everyday life.
And maybe another really good example is that, you know, people have become more and more aware of these epidemic diseases that are around the world, the bird flu, SARS a few years ago. And really, without understanding the organism that makes us have those diseases and how that organism evolves, we would have no ability to combat them. And so taking an evolutionary point of view has led to advances in our treatment of AIDS in particular. AIDS is caused by a virus. The virus evolves extraordinarily rapidly inside a single person's body. And that evolution is actually why a treatment that's applied for some period of time begins to lose its effectiveness. Essentially, the treatment is selecting on the virus, and the virus, the individual viral particles that are able to evade that treatment are the ones that survive and reproduce, and you get evolution within this person's body. And so you have to change the treatment in order to accommodate this now evolved and different virus. And if we didn't know that, we wouldn't be able to treat those patients. And that's true essentially for any disease that's caused by another living thing, which are all the diseases caused by bacteria, by viruses, etc. And so really, evolutionary thinking is extremely important in medicine, especially in these kinds of diseases, certainly in cancer as well.
I can see that the knowledge in the area of medicine is profound, and also the same in regard to agriculture. But your point, Brett, about agriculture and sort of selectively choosing the cows that yield the most milk, that also brings up another aspect of evolution that has bothered people, and that is when human beings get involved in the process and try to manipulate it. So you have, for example, in terms of people who have seized on Darwin and then tried to kind of help it along, you know, sort of do the social engineering, you've got Alfred Russel Wallace coming along at the, you know, a sort of colleague of Darwin, saying the intellectual and moral, as well as the more physical qualities of the European, are superior. And these enable him, when in contact with the savage man, to conquer in the struggle for existence and to increase at his expense. And you also have miscellaneous racist comments made. The careless, squalid, unaspiring Irishman, fed on potatoes, living in a pigsty, doting on a superstition, multiplies like rabbits. The frugal, foreseeing, self-respecting Scot passes his best years in struggle and celibacy. What will happen to evolution? So let's talk about that. When you have human beings using evolutionary principles but manipulating it, does that then take it into a different realm?
That's an interesting question. I just want to make sure I understand. Are we talking about human beings using knowledge about biological evolution in a political manner? Or are we talking about human beings changing the way they treat other animals and plants and other organisms in the living world based on evolutionary principles? Which one are you?
I don't know. I think I'm just giving you a hard time.
Okay.
But basically what we do when we breed for the superior cattle is something which, when you put it in human terms, we have great objections to, because if you take this survival of the fittest kind of idea, then you would cruelly look around you at the weak, at the people who have various genetic disabilities or problems, and you would get rid of that. And you know, then you get into the whole Superman notion that has been problematic. And so another way that Darwin has caused sort of controversy is when you do start applying pure science to human beings, then it sort of encourages us to look around with cold, callous eyes and look at where are we heading.
Well, I think that's a very interesting point, and it's an important one. People seem to be quite threatened by what is quite obvious at this point, that we are animals, that we are animals, and that this knowledge allows us to do things that are truly remarkable. So let me just give you an example of that. One of the things that's done a lot in modern biological research is to use laboratory animals, which is not a controversy we need to go into too much. But most people are quite supportive of that idea because they believe that studying, for example, mice and rats tells us something about people. Now, this is anathema unless you understand evolution or at least tacitly accept the idea. Because if each of these species is not derived from a common ancestor and doesn't share properties that allow us to call them animals and so forth, there's no reason to believe that studying biological processes in mice has anything to do with what we see in humans. And yet people seem quite comfortable with that idea. They also seem comfortable with the idea that so many of us have pets and we relate to them on some biological level. People will describe, well, what is the source of that? Evolution, again, provides a very easy and intuitive explanation for that phenomenon that doesn't obviously come from other sources. So I don't know if that's addressing what you had intended, but I think this idea that we're animals and that we're multicellular and that we're cellular and all, you know, that we're primates and vertebrates and all of these properties that we have is an empowering, substantive concept, because it teaches us about ourselves. And my personal opinion is that while the focus on what makes humans special and unique is understandable and important, we have to be judicious and careful in the extent to which we focus only on the attributes of humans that are unique, because most of them are not unique. That's my personal take on it. So why not celebrate the fact, as Jenny said, that we're all related and that most of the basic biochemical processes in our bodies are the same ones that happen in bacteria? I think that's a great thing, and it's one of the reasons that we've made such progress in understanding ourselves.
Well, one of the fields that's taken off recently in the area of science is ecology, the tremendous relationship between the different parts of the biosphere and the way that even some unglamorous looking bug or bacteria plays a key role, that it's all somehow interrelated. How does evolution shed light on that or help us be better in terms of understanding conservation?
I think that's a really great point. There are a couple of ways. One is understanding those interrelationships among the animals that are part of, say, some biome, say the oak savanna in Wisconsin, is that each of these players, if you will, each plant species, each animal species, each fungal species has evolved by interacting with the other members of its community. And so we can understand better how those communities get structured and what kinds of consequences might come from changing an ecosystem and removing one of those important players or adding one in. So invasive species have shown us huge ecological changes. And taking an evolutionary point of view there, we might be able to better understand which species might be able to invade and what kinds of demographic, and by demographic I mean like how many of them might there be over time and how might they affect the other species in their community. And so evolution gives us a way of looking at that as well.
What about the effect that pollution has on evolution, or sort of the way that toxins, uh-huh, other things are influencing evolution in a way that we might not have thought of otherwise?
I don't personally know that much about that field of sort of ecotoxicology and then the evolutionary responses to toxins. I can think of human-induced toxins like pesticides, and there's a lot known about the evolutionary responses of our pest species to those pesticides, which is why we have to throw them away and get new ones all the time. Same thing as when I was talking about the viruses that are evolving in response to the medicines that people are given. And so, again, by understanding that the pests will evolve in response to our pesticides, we can do a better job of designing those pesticides and in how we apply them, and whether we apply a single one or a combination of them, how frequently it's applied, etc. So that's another important way in which evolution helps us in today's society. And maybe another one that's related to ecology is that global climate change is upon us, and it's happening fairly rapidly. In fact, pretty much in every single week's issue of Science or Nature, which are two of the top journals in the sciences, you can find at least one and usually more articles that document either the evidence for climate change or are projecting forward to see, you know, what sorts of things will we have to deal with. And from an evolutionary point of view, one of the big things is that human-induced climate change is happening much more rapidly than climate change has happened in the past. And that rate of change that we're causing is basically making it really, really hard, if not impossible, for the animals and plants that live in our world to adapt quickly enough so that they won't go extinct. And so that's a very big potential consequence of global climate change.
Well, I'm just thinking, too, that the evolution does touch on so many different disciplines within the field of science, you know, with both of you coming genetics, zoology, but then you're bringing in ecology, medicine. What are some of the other sort of scientific fields that when you do have a sort of evolution gathering like you're having, mm-hmm, with the Darwin Day, what are some of the fields that weigh in?
I wish I had the list. So we have a group on campus of evolutionary biologists, and I'd say there's at least 15, maybe 20 departments. And they range from departments in the College of Letters and Science, like botany and zoology, in psychology some, to many departments in the College of Agriculture, genetics, mm-hmm, horticulture, plant breeding, animal breeding. I mean, the list goes on and on. Veterinary medicine.
Yeah.
There are huge numbers of departments that are where some of the faculty and students in those departments are engaged in the study of evolution.
Yeah, it's very exciting. There's even some of Darwin's ideas have even led to major advances in computer science.
It's true.
How so?
Do we get those
of us who are not good at it get?
Well, that's one example, yes. That is one way to. That's an interesting. I wasn't thinking of that, but that's true. One example is that in computer science, people spend a lot of time trying to develop efficient algorithms to do things, to sort through solutions to problems, for example. And there are lots of ways to do this, and I'm not an expert in computer science, but one kind of approach that came online recently was what's called genetic algorithms. And the idea here is that the search for the most efficient solution to a problem can be conducted by allowing the different solutions, for example, to sort of replicate themselves according to some selective criteria. So it's actually almost in silico evolution that can allow engineers and computer scientists to improve the efficiency of their programs. And this has now become an actual area of focus.
Well, when we return, I want to ask each of you about the work you're doing and how it relates to evolution, and we'll talk a bit more about Darwin Day. Back in a moment with University of the Air.
The news, the music, the discussions you hear on Wisconsin Public Radio often trigger a need for more information. It's available at 1-800-747-7444. Audience Services, 1-800-747-7444.
Charles Darwin is the Abraham of scientific men, a searcher as obedient to the command of truth as was the patriarch to the command of God. So said John Tyndall in Science and Man. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Jeanette Bauman and Brett Pazier. We're talking about Evolution Matters, a celebration of the birth of Charles Darwin, a conference that will take place next weekend, Saturday, February 10th, at the Madison campus, starting with a morning session at 9 in the morning in the Humanities Building. If you'd like a list of the events and the talks for that day, we will have a link to the Darwin Day celebration on our University of the Year website at WPR.org. Let me ask you, Jenny and Brett, a little bit about the talks that you'll be giving as part of this Darwin Day celebration. Starting with you, Jenny, I see that you are going to give a morning session about the irreducible complexity of the human eye.
Well, actually, it's how irreducible complexity can't explain the human eye. So basically, I'm just going to talk about all of the evidence that we have that eyes have evolved. And by doing that, looking at organisms as simple as a protist and humans as well.
Now, what was that first one that you gave? As simple as a
protist.
And what
so,
is that?
A little single-celled thing that swims around in the pond near your house.
And does it have an eye?
It has an eye spot, and it gives us an idea of what the first, simplest light-sensing organ might have been. And basically, it's just a collection of cells that can sense light. And this animal actually can respond to light. And that is effective and helps it out in its life because it's able to then migrate from, based on light in the environment, migrate from the shallow water at certain times of day where it might be feeding to the deeper water. And it uses light cues to be able to do that. And of course, we know how we use our eyes. And so I'll talk a bit about the sequence of eye types that might have occurred over evolutionary time. And just one thing of note is the eye has evolved, or eyes have evolved, many, many times. I guess there are at least 11 different optical solutions to an eye. And by optical solutions, I mean if you think of an eye as a camera, there's 11 different kinds of cameras. So we're not talking of different sorts of, you know, bodies, but in fact whether there's a shutter and how the shutter works and that kind of thing. So eyes have evolved many, many times throughout life. So I'll talk a bit about that, and Elliot Sober will also be joining me, and he'll be talking a bit about this idea of irreducible complexity, that when you've got an organ that's as complicated as an eye, how can such a thing evolve? If you have just a lens, what good does that do you? And so he'll talk a little bit about that.
I know you can't see this on radio, but mm-hmm. both of you are sitting here with glasses on. So if the eye has evolved, you know, you'd think somehow we'd be at a point where we didn't need glasses. Just a side point there. But it is, you know, as you were talking, I was picturing all the amazing varieties of eyes that are out there, you know, whether it's the eyes of an owl or mm-hmm. the kind of eyes that some animals have that can turn around and look at different directions. Mm-hmm. It is kind of exciting just to think of the variety that's out there.
I think so, too. And the different things that those eyes can see is also pretty impressive. And even the simple eyes are, I think, pretty impressive in terms of how they work and what they do for the animals that have them.
Well, and Brett, your talk is going to be entitled DNA and Human Evolution, a small topic, right?
That's right.
But can you give us some sense of you know, what your major interests are in terms of speaking about your field, genetics and evolution?
Absolutely. My intention will be to help people understand how viewing humans as another example of evolution is instructive about the evolutionary process itself, and conversely, how understanding evolution teaches us about humans, the biology of humans. And in particular, as you said, I'm going to focus a little bit on genetics because that's a topic of growing interest in the public as well as in the scientific areas. And so this includes a wide array of possible topics that I could discuss. But I think what I plan to do is walk through the human genome and talk about and describe how patterns of variation in DNA tell us directly, that is, provide sort of a historical blueprint of where we came from and what we've been through.
Can you give a specific, really concrete example of something that we notice about ourselves in the sort of history that you're talking about?
Absolutely. One thing that we notice when we look at patterns of DNA variation in different regions of the human genome, something that's fairly striking, is that DNA variation is organized geographically around the world. So one could imagine that it doesn't need to be this way, and people could just have sort of random DNA sequences that are not related to the population from which they're drawn. But of course, Darwin would say differently, and he would say, in fact, that individuals that are near one another are more likely to mate with one another, particularly in time periods in the more distant past, which are the time periods that we see evidence of in our current DNA, right? So we have to wait until the future to see records of what's happening now, just like a sort of historical writing record of what's happening. So one of the things that we see, as I mentioned, is that genetic variation is organized in a geographic manner. This is similar to what you see in other species.
Now, are you talking about what Darwin noticed, for example, with the Galapagos Islands, that if you have an island, you're going to have a completely different set of animals over a period of time because they have not mated with other species and they've adapted to that particular region?
So that's one aspect of it. But another aspect is that when we look at patterns of variation in the DNA of humans, what we see is that all signs point towards the continent of Africa as being the origin of what are called anatomically modern humans, so humans as we know them today. And we can see very strong signs of this in DNA. One sign in particular is that when we look at the DNA and compare the DNA sequences of samples of modern humans to reconstruct the place of the common ancestor that we all share many generations in the past, that common ancestral sequence arose in Africa, and we can see that.
How can you see it? Elaborate on how we can.
Well, if we sample individuals from around the world, and this has now been done for thousands of individuals, and we look at particular pieces of their genome and look at the sequence, we can identify pieces of the sequence that tell us about who is most closely related to whom. And when we do that in a more rigorous fashion, what we find is that the deepest sort of splits in that tree, that picture of history, and the way that the sequences from these people join progressively as you go back in time, that the deepest split is a contrast between individuals who live in Africa and the rest of the world. So, if you will, the diversity that you see in Europe and Asia and the Americas and so forth, much of that is a subset of the diversity in Africa, suggesting that that was the ultimate source of that variation.
And what are the implications of that?
Well, the most obvious implication is that in complete congruence with the fossil record is that we're all, as Jenny said, we're all related and we're all of African descent. That is one literally, right, in the meaning of the word descent. So I think that's a wonderful thing to think about biologically. But a more direct implication of that, of course, of all of these things I'm talking about is that, or maybe a more sort of practical implication, is that where you're from recently, where you live, actually says something about your genetics. We can kind of partition variation that identifies an individual as coming from a particular place. We can put that into one clump of the variation, and then there's another clump that is not directly related to where an individual lives, that is part of this larger pool of variation across the human species. And we can actually now begin to quantify the relative pieces of that pie. And so what I had started to say is that human variation is organized in a geographic manner, and that's true. On average, individuals who live in Wisconsin are more closely related to each other than people who live in Thailand are to us. And so that's useful. But another thing that was actually discovered many years ago and has been confirmed by looking at DNA evidence from across the human genome is that despite these differences among populations, which are quite interesting, that the vast majority of variation across the whole human species occurs within populations. If we take the total amount of variation and break it into between population differences and within population differences, the within part is larger. And of course, what this means, going back to something I was referring to before, is that it means that humans move around a lot. It means that although differences among populations are quite interesting, we have more in common than we have different on the DNA level. And some people would consider that a fairly profound discovery.
I heard Yolanda King speak recently here in Madison, daughter of Martin Luther King, and she actually brought genetics into her talk about racial understanding. If I remember right, she pointed out, and I don't know if this is exactly right scientifically, but I think she said that 99% of our genetic makeup is the same from person to person or something, some kind of figure like that. She used that to suggest, you know, that finding common ground among the races was something that had a genetic basis.
Yeah. Well, something that's very interesting is when I talk about partitioning the amount of human genetic diversity into these pieces, one thing I didn't say is that the overall amount of genetic diversity is, in fact, quite low. As a species, compared to other species, we are relatively depauperate of variation. So that's just another way of saying that no matter what we may choose to believe, we're all very similar. That common ancestor, you know, that lived some many generations ago is probably, the number of generations is probably fewer than a lot of people would suspect. And we're a young species, and we really do have a lot in common at the genetic level.
If you imagine having a Darwin Day here in Madison 10 years from now, and I know there's also Darwin Days at the UW-Whitewater, it's sort of a growing interest in establishing February, somewhere around Darwin's birthday. What is his actual birthday?
The 12th.
Okay. A time right around then is a time to think about Darwin. If you imagine 10 years from now, I know scientists don't tend to like to speculate, but I'm going to ask you to do so. What do you think we may know about evolution or how we will have evolved in that time period in terms of our understanding or acceptance of it? Where do you see things being in 10 years?
Well, from the scientific point of view, I think some of the areas where there's major progress being made right now is in studying and understanding the genetic basis of a lot of the traits that we as people have that are important to our survival and, you know, the things that we can do. And certainly the same is true for other species as well. And so I think that area is going to see major growth over the next 10 years. The fact that the human genome is fully sequenced and there's all this interest and focus on taking that data and trying to understand what it really means, I think we're going to see major, major improvements in our understanding of human diseases, the variation among populations in the phenotypes that we actually do notice as being different. I think we'll have a better understanding of that as well, and a lot of other things related to the fact that we now have so much information about our genetic basis.
I think there are a lot of really exciting discoveries that are right around the corner, and I'm biased in believing that a lot of what's happening in genomics is going to be key to that, because it really allows us to look at the evolutionary history of organisms in an unprecedented fashion, and that's very exciting. But I also think one thing I would say is, in keeping with the topic of our discussion today, is that in 10 years from now, I think we'll certainly know more about evolution than we do now. But I'm going to make the prediction that all that will happen in the next 10 years really will support the ideas that Darwin had, the major ideas that we've been discussing. And that's just a conservative prediction based on the fact that every previous decade since he threw out this idea, that's exactly what's happened. It's just been a continuing accumulation of evidence for Darwin's ideas.
I would just say that from the point of view of the understanding that the public has about evolution, what I would hope is that the scientists who study evolution are able to do a better job of communicating what it is that we know, helping people to understand Darwin's theory better than they currently do, so that some of these controversies can be sort of put to rest, and hopefully we can go forward from there.
Well, thanks to you both for doing just that in this hour of University of the Year. My guests have been Brett Pascher and Jenny Bauman from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I'm Emily Auerbach. I hope you'll join Norman Gilliland and me for the next hour of University of the Year.